Welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Daniel Angerdon, joined today in studio with Kathleen Driscoll, who's teching for me. So thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks for having me.
Today on our show, we are welcoming back Kim Socha, who we had on a few years ago after she wrote her book, Women, Destruction, the Avant-Garde. And today, she's written a new book called Animal Liberation, Atheism, Dismantling the Procrustean Bed. I'm really excited to have Kim on the show. She offers a really excellent voice, and I absolutely love the book. So I'm really excited to share that with all of you today. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you for having me back, and thank you for the kind words about the book.
Oh, no problem at all. So I'm hoping that maybe we can just sort of jump right in. I've got tons of questions. So just starting with the title of the book, you talk about this in the first few chapters, but maybe to explain to our listeners who are not familiar with the idea or the term of a Procrustean bed, where that comes from and how it fits in with what you talk about in your book about animal liberation and religion.
Sure. That has been in book talks I've given and a few interviews, that's been a recurring question. It's just, what is this Procrustean bed? So I went super direct with the main title and a little more obscure with the subtitle. But I think it fits well. Procrustes is a character from Greek mythology, and I learned about this story as an undergraduate, and I always just found it fascinating. He was a murderer and a thief, and he lived in an inn, and he would invite people into his home and put them in a bed for the night, and he would fit them to his bed. So if somebody was too tall, he would chop off their limbs to make them fit. If somebody was too long, he would stretch them out, like on a rack, so that they would fit the bed in that way. And if someone fit perfectly, he would just move them to another bed and then stretch or hack, whatever he had to do to make them fit. And what this term has come to mean, it's certainly not a term that I've made up, but I think, again, it applies well. It's come to mean whenever you try to make something fit where it doesn't. It's kind of like a simpler way to say it would be a square peg in a round hole, where you want something to work, so you try to force conformity. And that is what I see religious arguments for animal liberation to be, are Procrustean beds, where the works that I've read, barring some of the more honest ones, which is not to say the authors of those other books are dishonest, but books such as Matthew Scully's Dominion is much more open and saying, and even Andrew Lindsay says certain things just, they don't fit. How do we account for this? But most people looking at animal liberation from a religious perspective are simply making a Procrustean bed. You're arguing for something that the very books and traditions of your religion completely either oppose, negate, or are indifferent to. So that's where how that fits into the book title.
Right. Getting into the content of your book, it's divided into a few sections. And the first one talks about religious arguments for veganism, and the second one talks about atheist arguments. And so I was wondering if maybe we could start at the beginning. So animal rights activists who use religion in order to back up their claims or their arguments, you note that there is a bit of a flaw here, and this relates to the Procrustean bed. So would you be able to elaborate and maybe respond to how using religion to necessarily like justify animal liberation does not quite have as much fruit as it should, I guess, for lack of a better word?
I think what I would first have to do is explain how I see liberation, because you can make arguments for some pretty crappy welfarist approaches, I think, if you're going to use religion. But how I see liberation is kind of an approach towards speciesism, which is negating this idea of human superiority, which is to knock humans off the pedestal of the hierarchy of life, and to say that, yes, we are, as animals, part of this circle of life, but what modern culture has done is distort whatever use animals can have for other species, has distorted that beyond imagination. And liberation will be when humans no longer rely on animals as food, clothing, as sport, entertainment, in medical testing scenarios, and research. So that's how I define liberation. It's also liberating the human mind from this idea of their own exceptionalism and superiority. And that's where we get to the fault of religion. As I note in the book, is every one of the religions I looked at, and there are some that are better than others, which I note, but I do engage in a form of polytheism, where I don't just go to the worst offender, which is Christianity. I look at Eastern religions, including Jainism, which is seen as a vegan religious alternative. And if you read up on Jainism, it certainly is not. But all of these perspectives center on this idea of human exceptionalism, even the ones that are kinder to animals. So in this world scenario, humans in Christianity and in other Abrahamic traditions, such as Islam, are clearly made in God's image. Humans are special. I mean, the Bible clearly states, and this is the one thing I would bring up for anyone who would say that, well, the Christian Bible supports animal liberation. It clearly states animals are punished because of human sin, even though humans are animals. I'll use the human-animal rhetoric because it's easier when talking about these things. Because of human sin, animals are going to live in fear of humans. Well, how ethical is that? Because humans chose to defy God's law, animals are now their food. Before, there was a paradise where, you know, the lion laid beside the lamb and the child laid beside the viper and all of this wonderful imaginary world. And then if you look at something such as Buddhism, which many Buddhists are vegetarian, although it's not a requirement to be Buddhist and vegetarian. Humans, and this is obviously a religion that's kinder to animals, but humans in Buddhism, that is one of the highest levels you can reach. You can also become a bodhisattva or reach nirvana, but to be human and be reborn as an animal, as a non-human animal, is a step down in the hierarchy of value. And if you live as a human, if you live a bad life, you're going to be reborn as an animal. All of the, as I note in the book, the injunctions against eating animals are in some cases because why would you want to cause terror to another creature if you don't have to? But a lot of it is also about karma. And it's about one of the quotes, it might have been Christopher Chappell who I quote, says, it is always about the splendor of the human soul. So that's why religions, which are anthropocentric or maybe even anthropomonic, which means even a step beyond anthropocentric, because that the other term means it focuses on humans and gives some consideration to other animals. But there are, I think religion is really simply focused on human beings. Even though the Pope recently said dogs get to go to heaven as well, where proclamations like that come from, I can't even imagine. But so what we see is humans are always superior, are always exceptional. And how can you ever have liberation with that mindset in place?
Precisely. And I really am glad that you brought up that human exceptionalism, particularly because I'm reminded of, I took a philosophy class a few years ago, and the professor told us, imagine what the god of birds would look like, right? Like, it would look like the bird that was, you know, in the most power, that was the most, you know, beautiful to birds. And I thought that was kind of interesting because it really does come from a hierarchical standpoint in terms of, like, the gods that we create. One thing that I was interested, you did a lot of study of religious texts and of the contexts of various religions. And one thing that I'd like to speak to is how are animals addressed in most texts or in most religious viewpoints? You do sort of allude to the treatment of fish and pigs. And I was curious maybe if you could share with our listeners, what exactly are some of the beliefs that are being shared about non-human animals in religion?
From what I've seen, animals are always side issues. They're secondary. They're either dismissed or, in certain cases, they are required to be slaughtered. Religious texts are also saying that, for example, I cite, and I don't want to say the title because I know I'll mess up the pronunciation, but I cite a Buddhist text that seems extremely animal-friendly. I mean, it has Buddha, and, you know, there are conflicting books, of course, because it's religion. You have Buddha directly saying, this is years after the historical Buddha had died, but you have Buddha saying, I am unequivocally stating, and this is my paraphrase, do not eat meat. It is forbidden to eat the flesh of other animals. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember reading this and thinking, this is kind of like a contradiction to everything I've read so far. But then what it comes down to in that certain instance is, otherwise you might fall into the wombs of those flesh-devouring creatures, meaning if you eat animals, you might be reborn as an animal. So be nice to them. So we have religions such as Jainism, you know, and Buddhism and Hinduism, which are be kind to animals, because this is going to come back and affect you as a human being. I forget the exact percentages, but I think I noted in the book that the Bible, there are maybe about 200 passages that actually mention animals. And when I say mention, some of them are just, they mention them. There is not one, and that's like less than 1% of all biblical verses in the whole Bible. So that tells you how important animals are to Christianity. And none of them are animal friendly. There's even bizarre passages where if a woman tries to have sex with an animal, you should kill the woman and the animal. If a man rapes an animal, that animal has to be killed. Like these bizarre, I mean, they're not only indifferent at times, they're bizarrely cruel, where animals suffer for human sin. I think the Quran is more positive towards animals, but not an animal-friendly text at all. But it is actually an improvement from the Bible, but I'm measuring improvement without much criteria here. The Prophet Muhammad says, all will be counted at the end of the day. All beings are part of nations and worlds. So what's nice, like, okay, we see this, they're acknowledging that these are worlds, these are separate worlds, but there's nothing like that in the Bible. But yet, eating meat in Islam is permissible if it's done in a certain way, and I've seen images of halal slaughter, which are just brutal. You know, like kosher, it's supposed to be seen as more humane. And then I think the best views, which are even somewhat better than the Eastern views, are some of the views of animals from indigenous traditions and neo-pagan and paganism, where we have a real sense of people who, there's still that element of the supernatural world at play, but people who are, or groups who are saying, like, I am of this earth, I am an animal, and there's a real sense of a circle, that getting back to that circle of life. Yet even in those traditions, for example, in some native traditions, animals can only die if they want to. So you're kind of absolved from questioning, do I kill an animal? Because an animal can only die if he or she is willing to sacrifice himself to humans. In other native traditions, there's a goddess at the bottom of the sea who sends up her children for people to eat. So we really still see this human-centric focus. And I think when people try to cling to traditions, especially if they're appropriating indigenous cultures, they're trying to hearken back to a different time and place when the world was different. And to survive, things such as hunting and using fur for protection were needed. And it's just, again, frustrating that we have alternatives and people are not willing to take advantage of those. Again, I mentioned Matthew Scully's book, Dominion, and he has a great quote in it. And it's written from a religious perspective, but a much more realistic one, where he says, what were once necessary evils, hunting, killing for fur, once they're no longer necessary, they just become evil. And I think if anyone were to ask me what's a religious book that you would recommend, I would recommend Dominion. Because here we have someone who is religious and saying, you know what, the Bible, you could go either way with it. You know, you can make any Jesus you want. But the truth is, the Bible does not say some nice things about animals. And we have to reassess what our values really are, if it's convenience and pleasure or just the fallout of tradition.
You mentioned how different religions have varying official views on both non-human and human animal treatment, and there's, of course, variants of those within. So how does the question of the animal play into religious thought, and how/why does atheism subvert this?
The idea of the animal has served many different purposes. I note very briefly in the book that animals, just like women, have served the role of God in certain cultures and traditions. So they have been gods who were worshipped, but that has never led to an appreciation or an end of the oppression of, let's say, cats who were worshipped in Egypt. Or women, female deities, I should say, not women, who are worshipped in certain Hindu religions. In Catholicism, which is what I was raised in, women are the blessed, of course, she has to be a virgin, is glorified in a sense as a divine being. So animals have also served a role, so as a role of God, as protector, also as sacrifice, as food for humans. Again, there are clear directives. Interestingly, there is no requirement in the Bible. God does not say, lowercase God, does not say you have to eat animals to be okay by me, but there's a complete indifference to these creatures because humans are, you know, to put it as bluntly as possible, humans are better. Humans are a step, not just one step up, but a step way above and beyond other creatures of the planet. So what was interesting when I started, in order to kind of focus my research and not just try to read everything ever written about atheism, I focused on the atheists with the most cultural cachet, and those are the new atheists whose works I have read, but I reread them with a different focus to write this book. And mainly, I do talk about Christopher Hitchens, but I mainly look at the work of Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris. Well, I believe Sam Harris was vegan at one time, but now he isn't for medical reasons. And Richard Dawkins has been called out on why he's not at least vegetarian. And he has declared Peter Singer to be a more moral person than him because Peter Singer is a vegetarian, though not vegan. So what I found happening in these really wonderful and rich atheist texts were some great arguments for animal liberation, for veganism, and for challenging and ending speciesism. Unfortunately, it happens in a footnote. Sam Harris directly says, really, by any way we're going to judge ethicality in this modern society, factory farms, where 99% of people get their animal products, are ethically indefensible. But he stopped short of actually taking that step and being vegan. And Richard Dawkins is the same way. He says it would be more moral and ethical where this chain leads. When you give up human supremacy, it leads you to a new view of animals, a new view that Dawkins himself, I quote some of his brilliant passages in the book, where he's like on point, and you would think, for sure, that this person is, if not an activist, at least someone who doesn't consume animal products, but they don't. Other people have noted this, and the way I found out is through, so of course, I'm wondering, well, wow, how could they be coming to these conclusions and not at least be vegan or include animals more regularly on their agenda with who they're attacking, basically. And there's a website about cultured meat, growing meat in Latin and things like that, which kind of has a little like hall of shame of people who should seem like they should be vegan because of what they say, but they don't follow up on it. And there was Harris and Dawkins were noted on this site as well. Like, how can you say that and not act on the very ethics, not act on the ethical conclusions that you've come to? And part of that comes from this idea. I cite the French philosopher Michel Onfray, who pulls from the work of Nietzsche, this idea of, well, you may have given up God, but you haven't given up what the idea of God gave you, which is still that sense of human supremacy. Although, let's say, Sam Harris says some wonderful, like, positive things about other species, he ultimately declares that, oh, maybe farms aren't really that bad. And it doesn't matter to him. The way he justifies eating meat in his book, and again, this is all in a footnote, is that someday, it was unbelievable because, you know, the new atheists are so focused on the use of logic and reason. And his rationale for continuing to consume animals is someday super beings may come to Earth and want to use human beings as a food source, and he would have to accept that lot in life. Now, he knows that's not going to happen. And if that's the best argument he can give for continuing to consume animals, I think that's actually, again, unreasonable. And it's also just a way to slough off the real ethical issues that people don't want to address because they're used to feeling and acting superior to other species, which includes the right to consume.
Exactly. And I'm really glad that you do bring this critique. And you suggest in the book that the atheists' domination over animals is sort of a latent after effect of the religious cultural entrenchment of the great chain of being. And it's really interesting because you do sort of call out this inconsistency with these atheist scholars. And would you be able to perhaps expand a bit more on where the idea of this great chain comes from and how you like sort of flatten those hierarchies in your book?
Sure. The idea is, well, it was adopted by Christianity, which we all know came into great power in the Western world and beyond. But it actually comes from the ancient Greeks, who just had, it's kind of a schema of an idea for what the universe, for what the world looks like. And it's a like a ladder, it's a hierarchy, where God is above the hierarchy as the creator of all things. And then you have things like angels and demons, and then you get down to humans, and that's divided into men and women, and then down to, they actually include some celestial bodies in this chain, and then there are animals and plants, and then like dirt. And this chain of being, really what it means for life on Earth, I do a simplified version of the chain, and what it means for life on Earth is like, this is the hierarchy of rights. So humans, the simplest way to look at it is humans, animals, and then non-sentient or inanimate objects or beings, because of course plant life is alive. And so what I showed is how easily, once you become an atheist or any variation of that identity, you just kind of lop off the supernatural part, but you still have the hierarchy intact. So one might someday decide, you know, all this stuff that I was born, you know, that I was raised believing in, I don't see it as true anymore. But suddenly everything doesn't change. Your whole worldview, even if you were raised atheist, and a meat eater, your whole worldview doesn't change. And there's not necessarily a direct flash of lightning moment where, oh, so I'm getting rid of all the supernatural stuff. So this could also mean that the Bible was wrong about humans being exceptional in some way and humans having dominion over the planet. Most people don't come to that conclusion. And what's interesting is why I note certain atheist writers who have come to that conclusion, but they don't act on it. One person who was kind enough to review my book is Michael Shermer. He is founder of Skeptics Magazine, and he writes for Scientific American. And I thought his blurb was very important. And the reason I even contacted him, someone who might possibly review the book, is he had done a review of the movie Speciesism, where he didn't realize it until he saw that movie that he's a speciesist. And what he said in the review is, once you give up your right, your somehow, again, cosmic right to have domination over all other beings of the earth, that, according to him, he says it much better than I do, it's on the back of the book, that then leads to more consideration of the other animals with whom we share this planet. And then that leads to, hopefully, giving up one's speciesism. So I actually don't know if he's vegan, but I'm like, well, you know, I didn't directly ask him, but here is someone who is a well-respected atheist thinker, and he could see that connection. And again, I see others making it too, but simply not for reasons of tradition. You know, I've heard all the excuses. When Hemant Mehta, the friendly atheist, posted an excerpt of my book on his blog. He didn't comment on it. He just said, this kind of as a favor to the publisher, this book is out. Here's an excerpt. The response from the atheist or secular community was like vitriolic and filled with anger at the very thought that I would dare question humans' right to eat other species. It was like taken right out of, I thought, religious rhetoric. Like, it's my right, it's my natural right, you know, that kind of, it's the circle, you know, this circle of life, like, there is no circle, there's humans at the top kind of consuming everything in their path, at least in the West. Again, the vitriolic responses that I got from the atheist community predominantly proved to me that this idea of human exceptionalism, of being almost divine and being the pinnacle life on Earth, does certainly not fall away when someone gives up God.
Right. And actually, that it makes me reflect on a lot of other things that I really appreciate in your book that I think cross over. So, for instance, one thing in your book that I think is kind of absent from some of the other new atheist writings that I've seen is you will critique, you know, patriarchy or speciesism or oppression within any sort of religious texts, say like the Quran, for example, or the Bible, but without resorting to racist or Islamophobic, you know, vilification of, say, Muslim culture, which I think is really important to keep those things separate and sort of recognizing the other forms of oppression that can still occur even within like an atheist community. You critique racism and sexism as well as speciesism in your book. How can we maybe effectively communicate and improve discourse with those who have yet to include sort of a social justice or an anti-oppressive critique with their critique of religion?
I think the way to make that happen is to, there's this whole idea that's been gaining traction for years, the idea of intersectionality. To show that oppression is oppression is oppression. So many people want to see only the positive aspects of religion, and I actually really appreciate that you brought up my approach to Islam, because I was treading very lightly there. I don't think when people critique Islam who are Christian, it frustrates me to no end, because Christianity has, in order to gain the pinnacle of power and the stranglehold on world religion that Christianity has, They, and you know, we have today extreme factions of Muslims engaging in certain types of acts, but Christianity took over the world in the most brutal, violent way. The only reason they're not, except for people like killing abortion doctors, the only reason we're not seeing that now is because they're the ones in power. They don't necessarily have to outwardly engage in that, although there's still other types of oppression. So I really wanted to be, and I know that the new atheists are often, and not without reason, accused of being Islamophobic. So I just wanted to note that that was something I did try to do. And I really thought it important in the book to address, I focused on the Black liberation and women's movement and people in those movements who identified religion as a cause of their oppression, because, as I say later in the book, it frustrates me to no end that I can have a conversation with an atheist who will say, oh, religion's wrong about this, it's wrong about people of the LGBTQ community, it's wrong about women, it's wrong about race, it's been wrong about everything. But when you get to other species, it hasn't been wrong about that. So when I question people, well, if religion's been wrong about everything, according or almost everything, I'm kind of being hyperbolic, why has it been right about animals? And a lot of times, I mean, I would hope at that moment that at least a flicker of a light bulb goes off and people can see the intersection there of oppression, and that to critique a religion for its oppressive tactics against or views of a certain group is to look at how it views all different groups or all different segments of life on Earth, or at least that's the hope. That's why I felt it very important to try to ease animal liberation into the history of social progress that's happened in the human realm and start to bring other species into that conversation.
Thank you very much for bringing that critique. I was curious if we could maybe just learn a little bit more about you, Kim, as a vegan atheist. It's a subsection of, I think, the two populations that does exist. I consider myself to be a vegan atheist, and I know a few other people who are as well. And I was curious, first of all, sort of what brought you to these two conclusions about the world or these two sort of lifestyles for yourself? And maybe what is it about the vegan atheist or the atheist vegan that is unique?
Sure. I was raised Catholic, and this is interesting because I've had at least two other people tell me the same thing happened to them. They were raised in a Christian faith, and then in college as undergraduates, taking a world religions class. And I took my world religions class at a Catholic women's college, and it just, you know, happened to be taught by someone who I don't believe was Catholic. And I learned about all these other religious perspectives that seemed kind of nice. Like, I've been drawn to Buddhism before. It's arguable, but some say Buddhism is not a theistic religion, but that's beside the point. And I'm like, well, in my Catholic upbringing, I was taught that anyone not baptized in the Catholic faith would go to hell, even if they never heard of Jesus Christ. And I'm learning about these other religions that sound very peaceful, and, you know, I came to see that differently, obviously. But that seems actually better or more ethical than the Christianity I was raised with. So I started to then question Catholicism. And I had always had an affinity or more guttural reactions to animal suffering, I admit, than other types of suffering. It always troubled me more. It made me sadder. So I, you know, I did what many people do when they go off to college and start to become adults, is I also went vegetarian. But for a long time, I slowly gave up the religion, and I just didn't replace it with anything. And I just kind of floated around, just not thinking about it very much. But it don't, when I became aware of the harms arising from religion is when I really said, I'm not just a religious, I'm an atheist. I really don't believe there is a God in any way, shape, or form that humans have got an idea of on this planet. I don't believe that I'm going to continue on after this life. And I didn't necessarily see that as negative either. I think, you know, people think that atheists must just be so depressed because they don't get to be immortal. I mean, the ego in a concept such as that blows me away. But it led me to think, well, I better make the most of what I have here. My path to veganism was a little slower for the simple reason of convenience, tradition, and preference. I knew all the reasons to be vegan, and I've been vegan now for 6 years, but it took me a while to make that step because that cognitive dissonance you've heard of before, I just blocked it out. I convinced myself that, oh, the chickens aren't killed for the eggs, all these things we know. People, you know, they're going to die anyway. If I do this, if I become vegan, it's not going to change the world. But it was after, and I purposely avoided watching any kind of video footage of anything brutal because it would upset me too much, heaven forbid. And so I eventually just, I watched Shannon Keats' documentary about the Animal Liberation Front, and it happened to contain video footage of what goes on behind closed doors and how animals are treated. And at that moment, everything just came together for me and I went vegan. And I really think that I could not have come to that conclusion if I hadn't given up my place of power as a human being, if I wasn't willing to give up the supremacy and divinity, albeit in a secular sense or in a lay sense that comes with that role. So it was at that time that I, you know, was vegan and atheist. But when I think I became a vegan atheist, as I mentioned in the book, subsequently, this is proven by sociological studies. It seems like most people I was meeting in the movement were not religious. Some are. So there are many religious in the movement. But again and again, studies have shown this is a movement that is powered by free thinkers, whether it's agnostic, atheist, I just don't care about God, or however someone wants to define themselves. So it made me wonder that even though some of the most important works, for example, Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, are written by atheists, theological perspectives were still dominating. There's a lot of books on Christianity and animal rights or liberation. There's books on Buddhism, you know, there's anthologies that try to look at animals from all these different perspectives. And I think my identity as a vegan atheist formed when I said, well, why is there not a book? You can imagine a book called Animal Liberation in Christianity. Well, why is there not a book that unapologetically says, I am going to argue for animal liberation from an atheistic perspective. And it's really when I realized that, well, this is my identity. And what I found, at least from the small circle of people I interact with, like on Facebook and in person, is that a lot of other people felt the same way. You know, this is not something new that I had just realized that. I also did some research and saw people were writing about it. There's a blog site called Reasonable Vegan, which is, you know, skeptics writing about veganism, not skeptical of veganism necessarily, but writing about it from free thought perspective. I realized that they're both identities that we take on that tell the world we think they're wrong about something. So in the book, I explain, I was at a local atheist conference and someone from the LGBTQ community was saying, you know, when you come out as gay, you're not telling heterosexuals that their sexuality is wrong. But when you come out as atheist, she explained, you are saying, I think you're wrong. I think your belief system is incorrect. So then when you come out as vegan, what people hear is, I'm not saying that's what we say, but what people hear is, you are less ethical than me. So when you say you're vegan atheist, you're saying to those who aren't, I think you're wrong, and I think I'm more ethical than you are. And there's a lot of negativity that can come when you identify yourself in that way. But it also seems like the most honest way for me to adopt that label for who I am.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. And that actually sort of fits in with the next question I was interested in asking. I have seen studies that vegans and atheists are some of the most hated groups in at least the U.S., but I'm sure around the world in a lot of ways, and I'm sure activists can very much attest to or speak to bullying and, you know, very uncomfortable situations. You mentioned gotcha questions in your book about, you know, the like, oh, you know, then you shouldn't eat plants because plants have feelings or something like that, right? You also talk about how some people might not go vegan because of the idea of social rejection. So I was wondering if maybe we could expand on, maybe you could speak to the idea of these two groups as hated groups of individuals and what can be done about this, and how can we maybe get a bit more compassion, unity within these communities?
Yeah, I mean, I personally have gotten much more negative feedback for being vegan than for being atheist from the world at large. But then again, I don't do outreach as an atheist. I do outreach as a vegan. And actually, I cite a study in my book by some researchers. I think it was, I forget the exact university, sorry. But they did a study and found that atheists are amongst the most hated groups where you have like a religious majority, which they say is most of the world. They are put as less trustworthy or on par with rapists, which shocked me. Like, wow, this is, and you could see why. I'm sure, I think in the U.S. at least, it's like there's 12% of people who identify as some kind of non-theistic label. And I'm sure the numbers are much, much higher than that. I always, for some reason, have this secret thought that Barack Obama is an atheist, for example. But you couldn't say that. You couldn't say that and run for public office. In the whole U.S., I think there was one senator or congressman who is an out atheist. And I think the reason that both are hated in that way, and the hatred I experience when I'm doing outreach is, if I could just give an example, I did a protest yesterday, and I, you know, had a page set up for it on Facebook and everything, and people went, it was good, we got some media coverage, and someone who wasn't a part of the event, or I don't know who this person was, just wrote something about, what are you going to protest next? What, the poor plants, the poor little veggies that the farmer is pulling out of the ground? And, you know, my response to her, I think I shut that argument down. But I'm like, wow, here's someone who somehow she found out about this event and was so angry just to hear that people were out protesting for animals that she felt this need to write to a complete stranger, which people get very courageous behind computer screens or in front of computer screens, of course. And it gets me thinking, okay, so why are these groups disliked and or made fun of? And I think when it comes to being vegan, I'd like to think, I think, and this is a way we can maybe turn a negative into a positive, and maybe I'm being too positive here, but I really think the people who have those reactions are having them because something is being triggered in their minds, that you've maybe hit a nerve. And there is an element of guilt at play when they see somebody promoting veganism or going to, you know, a protest against fur or something like that. And there are people who are just angry and, oh, you should be protesting for humans, as if we don't. You know, they make all these assumptions about what vegans do and don't do. When it comes to atheists, I think part of the fear is if you don't believe in God, I mean, I'm sure, because I believed this for years because of indoctrination into Catholicism. If you don't believe in God, where do you get your morality? And that leads to this supposition is there is nowhere to get it. And you will do, because you don't believe in God, because you're not going to be punished or rewarded by this God. You'll just do whatever you want. And, you know, you'll lie, cheat, and steal because you're not accountable to anyone. And I think that's a very negative view of human beings themselves, as if I tell a lie or if I hurt somebody, I feel bad. I don't know why exactly. And I'm not going to spend that much time trying to understand. It could be selfish. I don't want to feel bad. So let me not hurt this person or let me not engage in violent practices. But I think that's what people fear about atheists, is that we are, you know, in my mind for years, it was synonymous, ironically and paradoxically, with Satanism. Somehow those two ideas got mixed up in my head. And actually, if one were to actually look at the official views of the Church of Satan in the United States, at least, they're atheists. And all they believe is kind of like neo-pagan, like, as long as you're not harming others, do what you will. Which is like, well, that sounds better than Christianity to me. But of course, I don't align myself with that particular religious, I think, is somewhat done for shock value. So I think there's, in both cases, there's a fear. You're messing with our traditions. You're telling us we're wrong and you don't have a right to do that. And I think that we can try to be a little more compassionate by understanding why people have those reactions. And I've had to learn in activist context, for example, not to like yell and scream, although sometimes I still do and just say rude things to people, but just kind of show them compassion. When someone's in my face being cruel and negative, is to show compassion in response.
That's very well put. And that brings me sort of to the next question. You have a quote in your book that science and atheism must never be dogmatic. Yet, I think one might argue, I'm not necessarily arguing this, but one might argue that there is sort of a dogma with veganism, or at the very least, that is definitely an argument that I have heard from atheist non-vegans, that veganism is sort of its own religious dogma, you know, you can't eat this and you can't do this, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was curious, what would be your response to this? Would you say this has a level of truth or not? Or how would you respond to those kind of arguments?
Well, what I did for the book to address it is I actually looked at, well, I needed to know, well, what is religion? So I looked at sociological, anthropological, and philosophical definitions. And I think veganism does meet some of the criteria. Absolutely. And especially veganism, as far as like activists who gather together and share the same beliefs and talk about those things. Where it's always lacking is as one unit, it's always lacking an element of the supernatural. So that's one reason why I don't think it is a religion. And I also don't think it has to, well, and some people might disagree with me, but I also don't think it has to be dogmatic, because when someone says to me, oh, you can't eat that, I always say, well, yeah, I can, I just choose not to. It's just, it's not something that I am going to be punished for. I mean, I could come home every night behind closed doors and eat cheeseburgers, and no one's going to know. So yes, I can do that, and there's no fear of reprisals. I just don't want to do it because it feels unethical to me. And I've actually come to look at certain very popular food items as non-food. I also think it doesn't have to be dogmatic, because what I argue in the book is veganism, as I approach it in the book, and as I imagine my audience, is for people who can be vegan. I'm not putting veganism out there as like a moral truth, and I'm very clear about that. Because if you're going to argue for moral truths, then you're basically arguing for God. you're basically arguing for some kind of celestial cosmic order of the world when it comes to morality and ethics. So, for example, I know that there are people in the world who live much differently than I do and live in subsistence economies or are still involved in basics. They're still in basic survival mode. And I am not about to call those people unethical or savage or brutish for what they do for survival. Because I would say someone like me who lives in an industrialized country, who is vegan but drives a car and engages in other activities, I probably have much more of an impact on the natural world, animals included, and the environment, than somebody in, let's say, Papua New Guinea, who with his tribe, you know, hunts down a boar or something. You know, I'm making up these images for survival. I'm not preaching that, and I use that term somewhat jokingly. I don't think that a truth has to be true everywhere in all parts of the world. And I think that's where the dogma comes in, because if vegans are going to be saying that, they're going to have a lot of answering to do when someone says to them, well, what about native people who live in the coldest climates of Canada? Are you going to berate them for not moving to a warmer climate where they can engage in a form of industrialized society that is destroying the planet much more than maybe a seal, the amount of seals, let's say, that the Inuit kill per year for survival? And maybe, you know, there are some vegans who don't want to hear that, and I don't like it. I wish no animals were ever killed for anything. But that is where I caution in the book. I caution vegans from being too dogmatic and saying this is the only way it is, because that's where the, I think, rightful accusations of elitism come in, of being so myopic in their view of the world that they think everyone has the same access to humane products that we do in the industrialized West. But I do argue that I think anyone who can make that choice but chooses not to, when they have the facts and they can make more ethical choices and don't simply out of preference and pleasure, I think that's where the real ethical dilemma lies.
Absolutely. When presented with the evidence and with the ability to make that change without too many negative effects, it certainly does speak to the idea of keeping your actions in line with your philosophy. We are running low on time, but I want to try to squeeze as many questions in as I can before we go. So for secular or atheist vegans who may want to treat veganism as their religion, what are some issues that might come into play there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not a major concern, but I think what happens when one chooses to do that is you place yourself in that role of the priest or the shaman or the one who has this access to some kind of truth that the rest of the world doesn't understand. And what could wind up happening is, with that mentality in place, with strict dogma in place, I could see some of the worst elements of religion. Of saying, this is an extreme example, but when you take on that role and you look at what religion is, it's a claiming of the truth. And those who don't adhere to that truth, violence is used against them, and force and oppression. Now, of course, being realistic, it isn't going to happen that the tables are going to turn and suddenly the vegans are in control of the world. But if that were to happen, let's say, veganism as religion, because of my negative views of what religion claims to be, which is, again, access to like a chosen people mentality where by force or whatever methods, you are going to act a certain way or believe this. So if I'm going to be opposed to the very idea of religion, I have to be opposed to the idea of veganism as religion. I don't want to live in a world where people are forced to be vegan, let's say, where by fear of death or fear of, which is kind of, it reminds me a little, that this idea reminds me a little bit of Eastern religions, honestly, where, oh, I'm not going to eat animals because I'm worried about karma. I agree, that's better. That's good for the animals who aren't eaten. But I really see animal liberation as a change in perspective of human perception of the world, which is a world with fewer hierarchies. I mean, I can imagine a perfect world with no hierarchy, with seeing the equal worth of all sentient beings on the planet. I can't see how religion, which includes, of course, a supernatural element, and which includes this idea of a truth that we are going to, in the worst cases, of course, force upon others by threat of death. We all know people have died because they won't convert to a certain religion. That's where I think the danger is. And it seems very extreme, of course, to even think that that would ever happen in the world. But I think that's what religion does. And we are capable of thinking of lots of different terms and ideas. And because religion is so heavily loaded with that history, I think calling religion an ethical worldview or an ethical stance is a much softer way than saying it's a religion and all of the negative connotations that come with that social institution.
Cool, well put. I'm glad you were able to talk to that. So we are out of time for today, but last thing I wanted to do before we go is just turn the mic back to you. So is there anything that we weren't able to cover today that you really want to talk about and people want to learn more about your book or the stuff you study? Where can they go to find out more?
They can go to, I mean, the book is available on Amazon. If you just type in animal liberation and atheism in Google, it'll be the first thing that comes up because I've Googled it, I admit. You can also get it directly from Free Thought House, which is the publisher, freethoughthouse.com. It's also available on Barnes & Noble, and you can get it at a much cheaper rate if you have a Kindle or a Nook. And right now, I'm not, you know, I'm thinking about where to go from here and kind of, you know, continue with this idea of a animal liberation and veganism and vegan atheology. And it's something that I don't want to let go. So I just hope people will, you know, make those connections, write about it in blogs. I'm not the only one, and I don't want to be the only one talking about this. And I'd like to make this part of a much broader conversation in the free thought community.
Great. Thank you so much, Kim, for coming on the show today. I really appreciate that you came on and chatted with us, and I hope you can keep in touch, and we'll hopefully hear from you again soon.
Excellent. Thank you again for having me.
No problem. Animal Voices is broadcast and produced at CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines, as well as CIUT 89.5 in Toronto. Big thank you to Kathleen for helping me out today, as well as our entire Animal Voices team.